This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Sexy and Surreal, a David Lynch and David Cronenberg podcast. I'm Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Terry Menard. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Joe. And I was just wondering if I could offer you some aquatic Brazilian centipede dust.
No, thank you. I'm only drinking the milk from Mugwumps right now.
Ugh.
I mean, this movie's very, very gay, but there's still something about watching people suckle at these, you know, proboscis
penis tentacles. I as we talked a little bit offline, this one was a weird watch, shall we say, and I don't know what is happening, but I will tell you that the increasingly growing penis, proboscis, tentacles, whatever they are, that are oozing basically cum, was not on my bingo card for this movie.
So, folks, we are on the Cronenberg side of the podcast. We're talking about 1991's Naked Lunch, which is, of course, an adaptation, I'm using quotations, of William S. Burroughs's novel. And yeah, this movie is a lot. I knew to expect this because I had seen still images of some of the creature work, which I think is amazing.
Yes.
And I knew that it was very, very queer. So I was anticipating we were probably going to get, I expected body horror because it's Cronenberg. I think this is more abject sexuality. And I'm fascinated because, you know, we talked about the kind of cold sterility of a lot of Cronenberg's films. So to watch him get his hands dirty in this like drug haze movie, like, this is interesting.
Yes, it's funny that you mentioned that, because while I was thinking back on watching this movie felt oddly warm for a Cronenberg movie, because we have talked about the detachment, and sometimes we've seen movies like The Fly where he really embraces more of the love angle of it, but like this movie, for all its weirdness and paranoia and drugs, and I'm going to say internalized homophobia, it seems like a very warm movie. And it's confusing. It was a very uncomfortable watch for me because there was so many, I couldn't feel like I could latch on to anything. Like, I was just like reaching out going, okay, what is going on over here? Oh, that, what, bugs? What, what's over here? Interzone Inc.? What is this? Is he an agent? Is he a sleeper agent? There's some elements of noir here. There's just a lot going on that I just was having a hard time kind of grappling with what it was trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, folks, if you've seen this film, then you probably have a sense of what we're talking about. But if you haven't, the whole film is presented almost as a noir-esque spy thriller, minus a lot of the thrills, because at the end of the day, that's really not what it's about. But it's all wrapped in a drug haze because the characters are just perpetually stoned. So there's an unreliability throughout the film where everything feels like, oh, it's just people tripping well high on this bug dust or bug parts or bug jism. And as a result, the whole film feels like it could just be a giant dream sequence.
Yes. And so I'm not familiar with William S. Burroughs' work, are you?
No. Yeah. So I think that this was a rocky watch for us in large part because we didn't have that familiarity.
Yes. I'll be honest. I don't know a whole lot about the Beat Generation. I have read, of course, Jack Kerouac's On the Road in college at one point. I have read that. But like, that is my entry point and exit point for the Beat Generation. And so I wasn't, When I started doing a little bit of research into William S. Burroughs and seeing his life, I was like, okay, I'm understanding this movie a little bit more in terms of it not being an adaptation of Naked Lunch, but being more of a drug-infused look at Burroughs's life as a whole in some weird way. And so that like helped me a little bit to like kind of reframe what I was recontextualize what I was seeing. But I still there's a whole lot in here. Like, I wish I could figure out what was going through Burroughs's head, because all I got from this, the big thing I got from this is about a man struggling with his homosexuality.
Right. Yeah. So I've not read Naked Lunch, but I did in my research discover that it is a book that doesn't really have a narrative, which is one of the reasons why it was such a challenge to adapt. So plenty of other filmmakers had wanted to do an adaptation, but none of them could get it off the ground. And even Cronenberg himself, who is on the record as being very inspired by Burroughs's work.
Yeah.
Initially, he was like, if you just did a straightforward adaptation, not only would it be banned in every country, but it would be exorbitantly expensive. So the compromise was this film, which doesn't try to do a straightforward adaptation. As you said, it's more almost about Burroughs's life and his creative process. And we'll get into the wife killing of it all in a moment. But the book Naked Lunch doesn't have that narrative. It has what Burroughs refers to as routines, or like excerpts, like sort of sequences, passages even. Mm-hmm. And some of those are directly quoted. You know, I think there's a certain amount of prose to the dialogue in this film, and those are often passages from Burroughs's work.
I wondered about that, because I was starting to try to take down some of the lines that were being spoken to see if I could do some Google searches, and a couple of them did come up. So I was curious about that, if a lot of that dialogue choice was from his work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because unlike a lot of the other conversations we've had about Cronenberg's work, you know, I think you and I, as film critics and as readers, because we both read a certain amount of fiction, we naturally sort of gravitate organically to, okay, we'll start with the plot, and then you can sort of work into technical aspects like the direction, the production design, that kind of stuff. But the problem with films like Naked Lunch is that they don't have a concrete narrative, or the narrative is more surreal, more cyclical, more hallucinatory. So it's really hard to hang a hat on. And it immediately makes it harder for us to gravitate, like, okay, well, where do we even begin with this conversation?
I think that's a good point, because I graduated from college with a degree in English. I am very much a textual reader. I want to go into that text. I want to see what is being said, what is being done, what is being shown, and try to figure out the themes and try to figure out what the movie is trying to say, if it's trying to say anything. And when we get to movies like this, I feel like this is more of a celebration, an examination of William S. Burroughs's life than it is a straight adaptation. And because neither of us are very familiar with Burroughs, it's going to be difficult for us, because it feels like we have to know, we have to have an appreciation for Burroughs as a person, as a writer, and what he did, in order to kind of understand the world that Cronenberg is operating in here, which is different than a lot of his other work that kind of stands on its own. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I want to circle back in a little bit to what you said about how this film feels warmer. I think we'll have some things to say about the representation of quote-unquote Tangier, which is where the inverse is technically meant to be set.
Yeah.
But why don't we start with Peter Weller as the protagonist, William Lee, who is obviously a sort of nom de plume of William S. Burroughs. So Weller is essentially playing the author, and I found this performance a little bit challenging. I mean, Peter Weller's is often a very sort of dry, understated performer from what I've seen of him, like not just RoboCop, but even something like Screamers, where he's in this wild science fiction world, but every line is delivered like very nonplussed, almost nonchalant. And here it's more of the same. You know, he's got this flat, affectless voice. You know, he's dressed like a PI because, of course, the film is set in 1953. But this is apparently exactly how Burroughs talks and dresses.
Okay, that makes sense. I think that there's a lot of interiority to the character.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's probably a lot going on in Peter Weller's head as he is performing this role. But it is so understated. It is so feels removed, like things just happen and he just sort of accepts it.
He doesn't react. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no reaction at all. And so I was kind of looking for something, because there's a couple times where there's a character named Kiki that is like rubbing against him. And I'm like, okay, what is his feels about this? Because it feels like this entire movie, he is saying that he's not queer, he's not a homosexual.
Right.
And yet there's a couple moments where that's not the case. But he is so detached from everything that's happening in here that it was challenging to try to get inside his head. And I think that might be purposeful, but then it mm-hmm. also is a little frustrating.
Yeah, it's complicated, right? Because Lee starts the film as an exterminator. And apparently right. William S. Burroughs was an exterminator for a point in his life. He wrote a story called The Exterminator. Yep. So, again, based partially in fact. And Lee says, I think it's when he gets pulled in by the cops the first time. He says, I'm married, I'm straight now, and I've got the best job I've ever had as an exterminator. No shade to exterminators, but like most people would not describe that as the most desirable job. But I'm pulling some of my reading from William Byrd's book on Cronenberg. So he has a chapter dedicated to every film up to a certain point. And the Naked Lunch chapter, I only had an opportunity to skim, but I am going to pull from some of what I read. And he mentions that the I'm straight part of that sentence is actually very important because you mentioned internalized homophobia. William S. Burroughs famously did have a wife. He did shoot her and accidentally kill her in a William Tell reenactment, much like we see what Lee does to his wife Joan in this film. And he ended up like going to jail for a brief time. He ended up like having to move and live in other countries because he was trying to like avoid the stigma. But he does eventually come out as queer. Like he had a relationship with an Arab named Kiki, like we see in this film. And I think a lot of this is the fact that he is always queer. He married Joan in an effort to like work around that. And even though he loved her, that queerness was always obviously still there.
So hearing this, because I didn't know some of that, I didn't know about Kiki, I didn't know about that aspect of stuff. However, I did find a quote attributed to him. I couldn't get it because it's an academic text that was digging into him. And so they only gave like kind of an abstract. But there was mm-hmm. one part that says, because it was looking about how he's not considered part of like the queer canon.
Oh, okay.
For writing. And it was, I guess the article is trying to dig into why that is. And they attributed a quote to him where he said, quote, I've never been gay a day in my life, and I've certainly never been part of any movement. And so as I was reading that, and I was thinking back to, because we covered Fellow Travelers.
Right.
And the idea about living as a straight person, but being queer inside and what it can mm-hmm. do. And the one character played by Matt Bomer literally says, I am not gay, I'm a homosexual, and then describes homosexuals as being man and sexual, as opposed to being yeah. a man who's interested in men. And so I it's interesting to me that we would have just covered a text where that was like a big push of the conflict, and then to mm-hmm. see this statement from Burroughs, who obviously is queer but does not yes. want to be associated with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of that is a reluctance or even a reticence to be engaged in the political discourse that comes with something like queer or gay, right? I mean, mm-hmm. the people who feel like sexuality is something that you perform behind closed doors in the bedroom. It's nobody's business but their own. And as a result, they don't want their name attached to the more political movement side of it, which is about rights and being recognized by society and politicians and so on. So I can understand that. I think it's also a generational piece, right? You know, Fellow Travelers yeah. is taking place in the 50s and 60s, principally. This book and Burroughs is very active in the 50s and 60s. Yep. So,
same time period.
Yeah. So, I can't help but wonder if a large part of this is, as you said, yeah, that internalized homophobia where you know what you are because you're still performing sexual acts that identify you as gay or queer, and yet you don't want the responsibility of the mantle being placed on you.
Exactly. Exactly. And that also might explain why he spent so many years outside of the States, where he mm-hmm. could find himself in relative anonymity, I would assume, enjoying being queer, but yep. like not having to not having to deal with the aftermath of that in the States. That's kind of how I was viewing it. I don't honestly know because, again, I'm not familiar with his work and stuff, but that was sort of the feeling that I was getting from both the movie and my limited ability to research him.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the opposite of what the kids say, right? It's fuck around and not be found out.
Exactly.
Okay, well, why don't we talk about the setting of this film? Because it's set in a fake place, you know. At one point after he kills his wife, Lee has to go on the run. So he gets recruited by this insectoid spy organization, and he is sent to Interzone, which is, as I said earlier, basically Tangier. So it looks like a fabrication of the Middle East. You know, we're seeing sort of a more sandy yellow filter applied. Cronenberg did actually want to film this abroad, but apparently there was actually conflict and he was not able to go where he wanted to go. So this is all shot in Toronto on a soundstage. But I would argue that it doesn't show quite as much as you might expect.
Yeah. Sorry, I was thinking back about that, about the soundstage of it all, and I'm trying to think that we definitely don't get to see a whole lot out and about. It's a lot of homes, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of shots of Fadela on the street.
Yeah.
But apart from that, yeah, it's a lot of interiors. So in some ways, I think Carol Spears, the production designer who always works with Cronenberg, she's able to cover for the fact. But it's an interesting adoption because it lends to the artifice in some ways of the film.
I was literally just thinking that in my head as you were almost to the exact phrasing that you just said, because I was like, yeah, kind of. I was thinking, yeah, it does. And then you start saying that. Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
But I love this idea that we're in this quote unquote fabricated world populated by, you know, these fantastical creatures. So we've got insectoid typewriters populated throughout the film. We've got this creature that eventually ends up also showing up as a typewriter, and then of course also gets milked by Fadela and some of the other, I almost want to call them terrorists, but I don't even know how to describe the group at the end. But these creatures are otherworldly, and they give the film a kind of fantastical feel that makes it like I could imagine this being in conversation with like the Star Wars cantina scene in some ways.
Oh yeah, absolutely, just with more alien jizz.
Yeah, with more alien jizz.
Now, okay, so you did bring up the design, the what is it, a mugwump? Is that what it's called? A mugwump?
Yes, yeah, which is a kind of like weird term for a homosexual. So it's defined
really?
As like a fence sitter. So you've got your face on one side and your ass on the other.
Oh, wow. Okay, that like just blew my mind right there.
Well, it's interesting too, because I didn't really know that Burroughs had disavowed himself of queerness, and the description that I read in Beard's chapter on Naked Lunch is that part of the semantics of that phrase is like the head is divorced from the anus, which to me is very much like, well, I'm not queer. Like I'm in the head. What I do with my ass is none of your business.
Huh. Wow. That just like recontextualized a whole lot in my head for me. That's wild. I had no idea that that's what that term meant. Mm-hmm. Wow. But okay, so I do want to talk a little bit about these creatures, because I was not prepared for a typewriter to turn into a bug with a
butthole
talking anus.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I have to say the queer subtext of desire in that first scene where he is taking the powder and he is literally rimming the asshole with it.
Yep.
Was like a lot. I was like, whoa, okay, this is going full into homosexuality and queerness in a way that I was not expecting. Because I'll be perfectly honest, I knew nothing about Burroughs. I did not know he was queer. I didn't know anything that he had written outside of Naked Lunch. Like I'm bad at not knowing that, and I was like angry at myself for not knowing that. So we get to this scene, and I'm like, wait,
Wait, what? What's
happening? what is going on here? And I literally had to pause the movie and pull up Wikipedia and start like reading about him because I was like, I was not prepared for this movie to go in that direction.
Well, and it's not a short sequence either, right? You know,
no,
the typewriter is framed as a kind of beetle with, yeah, like when the back opens up, it's basically a giant anus. And then that's what it talks out of. But then it, yeah, says, you know, hey, can you put some of the powder around the lips, around the rim or whatever? And you expect that Lee is just going to pour it like a little dash or something, which he does. But then he proceeds to rub for a long time. It's not even just one pass around the rim, baby. We're talking about like he's basically working this anus. And then when he gets home to his wife, Joan, who is played by the wonderful Judy Davis in the first of two roles in this film, she basically is a drug addict and she asks him to do the same to her lips. So it's like the sexual connotations are so obvious.
It's so obvious. And that was literally where I was like, okay, I got to go do a little bit of research before I continue watching this movie. Because I was not prepared, Joe. I, again, knew nothing about this. The only thing I knew about this movie was the line from The Simpsons when Bart and Nelson end up going to see this at the movie theater.
Right.
And they walk out and Nelson points at the sign and says, there are at least two things wrong with that title. That is all I knew about this movie.
Well, okay, so this movie is famously a giant flop, you know? It only cost about, I think, $18 million to produce, but it grossed less than $3 million, which is huge. Like, that is a major, major flop. And I can't help but say I'm not surprised because I feel like a lot of people were probably in your and my boat. I'm sure people who knew Burroughs were probably excited to see an adaptation of his most famous work previously thought to be unadaptable. But the reality is that can you imagine average people who were like, oh, let's go and see this new movie, it looks a little bit wild, walking into something like this? These scenes are so confronting.
They're incredibly confronting. And I do think that that's probably why it only had a $2.6 million haul, is that that was probably all the people that were aware of Burroughs, because he never came up for me in terms of reading. And I studied American literature. I studied that whole era of that whole time frame. And I still didn't know anything about this guy. So I can't imagine that a movie called Naked Lunch that is playing and you see the imagery in the trailers, which I'm assuming they showed some of the more, you know, creature feature-esque type stuff. Yeah. I can't imagine that would attract a huge audience, to be perfectly honest.
Well, even if you're a fan of Cronenberg, right? You know, here's the guy who did Videodrome, who did The Fly, who did Scanners. This isn't your typical Cronenberg. I mean, there's a lot of thematic consistency. Like, even the carryover theme around drug use from Dead Ringers to this makes so much logical sense when you know Cronenberg's filmography. You know, the idea of being pulled into a spy game where you're way over your head and being used by competing forces. We've talked about that on numerous Cronenberg films.
Yes.
But when you watch this movie, like, it does and doesn't scream Cronenberg, but I think if you're going based on your appreciation of his previous films, this one is going to work the least well for you.
Absolutely. Well, as I was watching this, the things that jumped out at me that were, okay, this is definitely Cronenbergian, was the way in which it meshed, like, inorganic material such as the typewriter with organic material such as the insects and the mugwump that shows up, you know. And so there's aspects of that that I was like, okay, this is definitely a through line of what he was exploring in the 80s. But in terms of like the narrative, there are some aspects, as you mentioned, with the drug use that was explored in Dead Ringers continues through here. But like in terms of everything that we've seen before, this feels like a different kind of movie for him. Mm-hmm. And it's also, I mean, we've seen a couple adaptations from him, but this is a very weird, it's a very weird adaptation.
I've been trying to hold off on using the word surreal, even though it is literally the title of our podcast, in part because I don't really view this film necessarily as surreal, even though so much of the imagery feels like it could be a dream, but it's not the kind of experience that we would typically classify as surreal. If anything, I would almost say it's fantastical or otherworldly, and those aren't descriptions I would typically use for Cronenberg.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating, like, how it combines this hazy drug use visual aesthetic with real-life events, you know, such as the real-life murder of his wife, however accidental it was, but even including, you know, obvious beat generation writers in the narrative. So we've got his two friends, Martin and Hank. They're played by Michael Zeneker and Nicholas Campbell, respectively, and they're basically stand-ins for Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering about that. I didn't get to go do a deep dive into figure out who they were supposed to be, but I figured that those were the two that they were. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard to overstate how weird the film is, and it's also not short, so you're spending a lot of time with these routines, I'm going to call them, because I do feel like they're carried over well from the book, where you always wonder if something is important, because in my case, I was trying to latch on to a sort of narrative progression. And we do kind of get that, you know, we learn that different typewriters produce different type of texts. Obviously, this is a not so subtle metaphor for the creative process as well as drug use. It's like, oh, okay, you know, I get really high, I use a different typewriter, I produce these different kind of quote unquote reports. And it's all about the writing process that ends up generating Naked Lunch.
Yes. Okay, so here's the thing. We're talking about trying to grasp onto plot aspects of this, right? Mm-hmm. And this movie is definitely, on paper, it seems relatively simple. It seems right. Like you could group it into specific types of subgenres. You could figure out the plot because it's basically a paranoid thriller. Mm-hmm. It's a spy thriller.
Yeah.
But it's also a weird biopic of his life at this mm-hmm. time of writing Naked Lunch. And so, like, on paper, these all make sense. And I could, like, reach into those. And I was like, okay, I really like what Cronenberg is doing to take basically the spy genre and overlay it over writers. And the different typewriters I thought was so fascinating. And you're right.
Ooh, yeah.
It ties into the drug use and the, well, maybe you should try this other kind of drug to see how that's going to help you writing is basically the implication behind it. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed seeing that. It's just, and maybe it's because we are talking about Burroughs's routines that he would use in Naked Lunch, where it feels like we're getting a bunch of vignettes and they're attached to each other, unlike some anthology type stories that we've seen. Mm. But it's just almost like scenes that are building upon each other, but then they're not at the same time. And I think that is where my inability to really kind of understand what's going on was like I feel like I'm actually learning more about it and recontextualizing it just by having this conversation than I did actually watching or looking up the plot synopsis of Naked Lunch or looking into Burroughs's life. That's weird to me.
See, that's funny. It's not weird to me, if only because I do think this is the kind of film that is frustrating on a first-time watch. Like, even me knowing a little bit more than you going into this, I still found the film, as I said, confronting, a little bit nonsensical at times. You know, I was struggling with it. And because it is long, it then almost exacerbates that experience where you're just like, what is happening? And I have to keep watching for another hour. So I think on a first time viewing, this is a challenge. But I can understand at the same time why the movie becomes a cult hit, why it ends up being released under the Criterion banner, because not only is the production design and the creature design fantastic, like such a standout, such a huge accomplishment, but I think the film really does reward repeat viewings when you're not struggling to make heads and tails or, you know, mugs and rumps of the narrative.
Mugs and wumps. I like that. That was a good turn of phrase. it's interesting because I think that this feels like a different era for David Cronenberg. Like I think this is, for me, his best looking movie.
Okay. Is it just because it's warmer?
Maybe. I think the creature effects are really, really, really good in this. And they straddle that line between being the surrealness, but also feeling grounded in some bizarre way I can't even really begin to describe. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the way the film looks, I was like, this film is, for me, was the best looking of Cronenberg's. It's definitely not my favorite of his.
Right.
So for a movie that looks this good, but is this incomprehensible, it feels very assured from a narrative perspective in a way that I know what David Cronenberg is trying to get at here. I might not understand it or get it, but in terms of what he wants to put on film, I do think that this is exactly what he wanted to do. And for that reason alone, I do think that this movie is, I think it belongs in the criterion for his filmography for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Dead Ringers is in there as well. Crash is in there as well. So this isn't the only Cronenberg film that has been celebrated. Right. But you're right, it does feel very confident. And I mean, I get the sense that Cronenberg is always in control. And I think control is another theme of the film, not just about who is controlling Lee and who is in control of your destiny, but also how do you take control of things like a drug habit, a writing habit, and so on? And I like the way that all of the things come together, even if at the end of the day, what I will probably take away from this viewing experience is more key sequences or key visual elements, as opposed to I like the film overall. Like, this was a film that didn't ultimately appeal to me, but I can definitely appreciate how much effort and how stylistic it is at the end of the day.
Yeah, I definitely am in the same camp as you in terms of I can appreciate specific scenes, and there will be sequences in this that I think will probably stick in my head for a very long time. What this movie made me want to do is go dig into Burroughs's writing is basically what I got out of this. I was like, I want to see what this man was writing, because I don't know anything about it other than my cursory research that I did before we recorded. Now, I do kind of want to talk about, you brought up the amazing Judy Davis. I do want to talk about this idea of doppelgangers with her, and I'm curious if you have thoughts on how the movie ends and what the movie's trying to say with her being killed in both doppelganger forms. Do you have any ideas on that?
The way that I read this is that everything that happens in Interzone is like a drug haze. So, you know, Kiki getting molested by Julian Sands in the birdcage, and
that scene,
it's horrifying. I wish the special effects had aged just a little bit better, because it does look quite like late 80s, early 90s, but you can see what they're going for, and it's really fucking impressive. The other big sequence that stands out for me is the sex scene with Joan Lee, where the typewriter takes a kind of centipede form and it ends up humping them. And I thought that was the most successful sequence for me. But I think a lot of this is meant to be Lee's drug trip, where he is trying to process his repressed homosexuality and also the murder of his wife, and figure out how to put that onto paper. And then the final sequence, where he's traveling back to America and he ends up shooting her again, is like, you have to confront the responsibility of your actions. You have actually killed a woman. This wasn't a drug trip.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if we are to assume that he is, at this point, embracing who he is by the end of it. Was my question as well.
That would make sense, if only because it's like, okay, I got to put down the wife so I can do the things I need to actually do, which is be the writer, not the exterminator, be the queer, not the married straight man.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Cause I was like, okay, why is this happening again? And what is the point of it? And then of course I found out that it's based on the real life shooting of his wife, and digging into that. So, yeah, so I'm curious, because William Burroughs did give Cronenberg the okay with the script.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, he was fine with these elements being included. I think if only because they really do define a large part of who he is.
Yeah.
Drug addict, wife murderer.
Internalized queer.
Yeah.
Homophobia.
Which is wild then, because it's really just splayed out on the screen, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I think his acceptance of it is surprisingly candid for someone that is quoted as saying, you know, he's never been a gay in his life. And I don't know at what time frame that quote was made. It might have been early on in his career. Who knows? But it's interesting to see this movie kind of wrangle with Burroughs as someone that has internalized homophobia and that does not want to admit that he is queer and is taking steps to sort of make it seem like he is playing as queer. Mm-hmm. Because there's that one comment earlier on, one of the agents that he is working for, which is, the typewriter, talks about how homosexuality is the best cover an agent ever had.
Yes.
And so it's almost like trying to give him an out of, like, you're not gay, you're playing gay.
Right.
And so I think that as we're digging into this, is like, it's almost as if him trying to come to terms with his homosexuality within this movie as a way of, like, I mean, you could take that line, because I'm thinking back to when I was struggling with, am I gay? Am I straight? Am I bi? What am I? When in my early childhood, my teens particularly, it's like, okay, well, maybe if I am, like, looking at bi porn, maybe that will, like, make it okay.
Yeah.
Yes. And so some of the lines in here made me think about him trying to rationalize, well, what I'm doing is for art, or what I'm doing is for these reports that I'm giving to the agent, and it does not define me, even though we know that it is a defining aspect of him.
Right. You know, that's interesting, because I struggled with this throughout the film as well, because it did feel like the gay aspects were more coded or sort of addressed in passing. Like, it's not as though the film is trying to hide that a bunch of people are experimenting or engaging in open marriages and that kind of stuff. But yeah, lines like, okay, gayness as a cover, and then also there's an implied sex scene that Lee has with Kiki, but we basically see the morning after. There's no nudity at all. Whereas we do get multiple sex scenes with both of the Jones. And part of me was like, okay, is the film afraid of going there, despite the fact that it is so queer and Burroughs is so queer? I don't know. I was a little frustrated with that depiction, and I will have more to say about that when we get to something like Crash.
Yeah, okay. Because I also struggled with this, because this movie made me really uncomfortable, because it felt like I was living in homophobia, like the movie. There's a lot of...
Yeah, we're dropping slurs.
We're dropping slurs. We're asking if he's an F word, and he talks about how he's not. And it just... I don't know. There's a lot of that confronting language, and then this idea of homosexuality as a cover, which is such an interesting turn of phrase when you think about how queer people had to use straightness as a cover for their sexuality for such a long time in America. Yep. So there's interesting turns of phrases there, but then everyone in this movie, none of the people in this movie seem very good. No. And they're all very loose sexually. Like, when he gets introduced to the Frost couple, he's told, the woman would have sex with you, the man, he only likes interzone boys, which gives a connotation of a lecherous and a predatory kind of character. And so that was like, oh, this is weird. And then we have Joan telling him, did you come to interzone for the boys? Tom and I did. And I'm like, that turn of phrase is very, very specific, because these are relatively older people, and then people like Kiki seem very young and naive, but they're not. But they come across as like that sort of young kind of character. And so I was like, there's some weird things here about age and class.
Well, and even Kiki comes off as a bit of a sex worker. Like, that's the kind of vibe that I got. He's a rent boy. And the fact that he is so disposable, you know, we mentioned the scene with Julian Sands as Yves Cloquet, and we learn after the fact that Lee was actually meant to be, like, William Lee was meant to be killed by him. Like, that's the kind of, oops, we sent you in and you probably would have been murdered, but instead you gave him Kiki, and Kiki becomes this disposable body in the most horrifying scene in the film.
Yeah. That scene in particular, like, he knew what he was doing. Yeah. Maybe he did not know what was going to happen, but he knew what he was out. Doing.
I don't think he thought he was going to be killed, but it was still exactly. Like, you know, Kiki, you're saying no, but I need you to go with him so I can get this typewriter.
Which is horrifying. And then when you compare that to some of the things that he says, there's this one time when he's having conversation with Eve and he tells stories, and there's two stories in here. And this first one was about this wise old queen named Bobo, who ended up having his guts pulled out from hemorrhoids that got caught in tires, but which is
so
upsetting
gross.
Imagery. Yes. Yeah. But like a side note, I could definitely see how someone like Chuck Palahniuk kind of maybe was pulling from Burroughs in terms of like the legacy of Burroughs's work, because he famously has that guts short story that is kind of similar in nastiness. But like I started thinking about like Burroughs's place within postmodern writing, but that's just a side note. The big thing I wanted to bring up was that, so as we're having this conversation and we're getting some insight into Lee, he talks about how his parents, the Lees, have always been perverts. So there, right there, is a word that bothers me when we're talking about queerness. He mentions that he was a homosexual, and then he thought of the painted simpering impersonators was a line that I wrote down. And then he makes a question, could I possibly be one of those subhuman things?
Yeah.
And so we have this dialogue that like just, and it's throughout the movie, this sort of look about homosexuality as being perverted or being something that he is not part of. And so when I'm getting to these segments where we're seeing sort of the inner workings of his mind, it just makes me so, it made me so really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. The film is really interested in perversity and how that intersects with sexuality as well as objectness, you know, like the sort of disgustingness of sex. And I think that that can extend mentally when you're thinking about quote unquote perversions and perverts and that kind of stuff. And I feel like that leads us into maybe the last conversation, which is the quote unquote cameo appearance by Roy Scheider as Videla, where he basically Total Recalls a costume off. And he's like very appreciative of what disguising himself as a woman affords him as an ability to once again pass.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say as a side note, that was one of the biggest surprises for me, was seeing Chief Brody in this movie pulling himself out of a disguise that was the Fidella for the entire movie. Like, I'm curious because I don't know a whole lot about him as an actor, but
no,
this did not seem the kind of movie that he would do.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat.
Mugwump jism can't be beat.
True words were never spoken. See, I appreciate that this was uncomfortable. Like, a lot of this was uncomfortable for you. To me, that's actually what makes the film fascinating. It's almost this manifestation of Burroughs grappling with his sexuality and like being disgusted by it, but also willingly engaging in it and enjoying part of the process. Like, oh, it's perversion, but also it can't be beat.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the movie ends with a bunch of people sucking on those mugwump stumps.
Sucking on them titties. Like dickheads, literally.
So, yeah, I don't know. It just like,
it's confounding.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Like, I feel like we're having a conversation about this as if this were like almost a Lynch piece that I'm just sort of trying to figure things out, because this is, in a way, this feels like the most Lynch thing that Cronenberg could do.
Indeed. Yeah. Which is why I was trying to hold off on saying the word surreal, because I'm like, no, that's meant to reflect the other side of the podcast. But yeah. And I still don't think this, like, I wouldn't use that word to describe this, but I do think saying this feels like Cronenberg doing Lynch does feel appropriate.
Yeah, and I don't think the imagery is that surreal, because when I think of surreal, I think of images that twist and turn and don't make sense. Like, every image in this feels like it makes sense in mm-hmm. some bizarre way. It is weird, but it does feel grounded in a way that mm-hmm. surrealness does not typically afford.
It makes sense for this world, for sure.
Exactly, yes. And so, yes, I don't think... I think the feeling that I got from this was one of surrealness, but in the way that, like, a fever dream would be, as opposed yeah. to just imagery that is surreal, if that makes sense. It was more of that feel that gives me that mm-hmm. surrealness, as opposed to what was actually happening on screen.
Agreed, yeah. Which is so interesting, given where we're headed next, Terry. So maybe before we say, although if people are paying attention and realizing that we go chronologically, you'll know exactly where we're going. But before we get there, Terry, if people want to talk about any and all of this wildness with you, how would they get in touch?
You will find me on social media at Gaily Dreadful. And Joe, if they want to talk to you about which typewriter you would want to write on, how would they get in touch with you?
The answer is the, like, Arabic one, because you can put your hands into it and then have sexy times, obviously.
Obviously.
I love the idea that they were typing out a very erotic report. That was a fun scene for me. But you can reach me at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And we'll thank the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network for hosting the show. But Terry, it's time to get deeply surreal and also very fucking dark, because we're headed back to Lynch. We're headed back to Twin Peaks, yes. But we're going back to before it all began, because we're going to watch the prequel film, Fire Walk With Me.
I'm very excited for this one.
Prepare to have your boots blown off, my man, because it is like a brand new tale mixed with things we already know. It's, we're going to have a lot to talk about.
I'm excited.
All right. Well, that's where we're headed next. But folks, until then, suck on that head dick.
Sucking on my titties like you wanted me, calling me all the...
Scream Pod Squad.